Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Mohammed Alarian, of course, about the events in the Middle East. And then we'll look at the financial. But Mohammed, I've got to ask one financial question that David Wilson just touched upon, which is this $130 billion transaction of Verizon and Vodafone. Is this happening because of Ben Bernanke? Is financial repression and then higher interest rates going to affect a merger frenzy?
You know, I smiled when you asked that question earlier in your show, and the answer is yes. I think as people recognize that there is still a risk of rates going even higher, they start moving. Don't also forget there's quite a bit of cash in the system. I think the real issue for most of us is, are these defensive M&A transactions or are they offensive? And what the economy needs is a set of offensive M&A transactions, meaning creating more jobs rather than just consolidating. And so far, the bulk has been defensive.
I like that nuance, the idea of the dreaded word synergy. We'll talk to Dr. Alarian about the new normal in economics here in a bit. Mohammed, an update here, and I go back to your wonderful book and a chapter in When Markets Collide, Investment Strategies, this book a few years ago by Dr. Alarian. Prospects for the journey. What are the prospects for the United States of America as we journey off the Eastern Mediterranean into Syria?
Uncertain. Uncertain because we don't control enough of the potential outcomes. Uncertain because we are responding to a huge human tragedy with imperfect tools and with less than a full global coalition. I think it's interesting to see the pushback that Prime Minister Cameron got in the UK, to see the UN saying we need more time, to see China joining Russia. You know, this is a complex issue. The market in the short term likes it because it means that the uncertainty is pushed back a little bit, but it puts the U.S., as you rightly said when you spoke to Juliana earlier, it puts the U.S. in a very difficult position.
And part of this is the timeline. I mean, I walked through the Egyptian art wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Mohammed, the other day, and I would just suggest that in general, the old world in the Middle East has a little bit different timeline than the United States of America or certainly politicians in Washington.
I think that's right. And I think it's also the longer timeline associated with major regime changes. You know, I was watching a few weeks ago Les Miserables with my daughter, and she's wondering, hey, wait a minute, didn't you tell me that the revolution in France happened a long time ago? Why are they still rebelling? And I say, well, because it took a long time for the French Revolution to pivot from dismantling the past to building a new future. These things take a long time because you don't have the institutions that allow for a faster journey.
Joining us this morning, Mohammed Alarian. Let me bring in my colleague, Joe Bersuelas. Joe?
Dr. Alarian, what do you see as the shape of change in Egypt, given what looks to be like a multifaceted domestic struggle?
The clear one, Joe, is what's happening at the grassroots level, the bottoms up. There, the individual Egyptian feels more empowered than ever. He or she has had a political awakening, and that is being translated in a lot more civic activities. We're seeing a lot more small-scale entrepreneurship. So the bottoms-up bit is very good. The top-down bit is very uncertain because you have neither the political leadership nor the institution to channel all this new energy into a constructive macro outcome. So that means economic instability, financial instability, and political instability in the next few weeks and months.
Is the West better off focused on building the civic institutions, which, as you say, take a long time to build in terms of a pivot away from the authoritarian past towards a possible liberal democratic future? Or do you expect the old ways to reassert themselves and we'll just see a simple focus on security and just implicit support for the Egyptian military?
That's a great question. I think what should happen is the former, which is facilitating and enabling the bottom-up revitalization that is going on. The temptation is the latter. And the latter is problematic because, as I said earlier in an earlier interview with Tom, the West cannot dictate outcomes anymore.
Are you surprised by the lack of regional coherence of the United States and UK focusing on a possible intervention into Syria, specifically with the situation on the ground in Jordan?
It's very hard, Joe. I mean, this is a really, really hard situation. There are no easy options. I actually feel very sorry for the United States and the UK, because they are deep in the world of second or third best, and right. any choice they make is going to have
this very... Then state the case, Dr. Alarian, for doing nothing.
The case for doing nothing actually was stated in an op-ed in the New York Times, which is that whatever you do, you're going to end up with an outcome you don't have, so it's better to do nothing. The problem with doing nothing is a tremendous amount of human suffering. I mean, don't underestimate the casualties involved. And this is a human tragedy. And there's a real moral issue, Tom, as to what should the rest of the world do.
If it's a moral issue and goes back to 90,000 deaths in World War I and all the images that we have, the literature that we have of the chemical warfare of World War I, and we state a case, what is the best procedure here? A unilateral or modestly bilateral procedure, or do we need a multilateral effort into Syria?
The best procedure would be a global response that makes it very clear to the Syrian parties that the use of chemical weapons, should not ever, ever be even thought about. So the best thing is a global response, but the reality of today's politics right. is you're not going to get it.
Mohammed, let's talk about emerging markets and the retest of a low in price and a high in yields. I spoke with Jagdish Bhagwati of Colombia today about his India. He made it sound as if it was a discrete domestic India issue, not something of the emerging markets. How linked are the emerging markets as we see the financial and market challenges they face?
They're very linked, and the global flows tend to amplify whatever's happening domestically. So the emerging markets in the last few years have gone through a major cycle. First, they received a tremendous amount of capital, and in some cases, the capital overwhelmed their ability to absorb it productively, leading to some pockets of financial excesses, overappreciated currency. And now this capital is reversing, flowing out, and is putting these countries under tremendous pressure mm-hmm. and putting their markets under tremendous pressure.
I'm going to put out now, folks, a chart of the FTSE Emerging Market Index. It's a blended index of equities worldwide. That'll go out on Bloomberg Radio Plus here in a second. Dr. Alarian, what lessons have the emerging markets learned? Stanley Fisher wrote a lot about this after the 97 crisis. You have written about this. Is it a new common sense for emerging markets, or is it business as usual that we go to a great crisis?
So it's not business as usual. And the one thing to remember is that this is a very differentiated asset class. So there are certain countries that learned the lesson from the previous crisis and that have self-insured tremendously. By that, we mean they have built up a lot of reserve cushions. They've termed out their debt, and importantly, they changed the currency composition of their debt from external to domestic. There's a second set of countries that maintained twin deficits, whose growth dynamics are low and who have limited reserves.
That would be Turkey.
Turkey is an example of that, and there are others. So we should expect quite a bit of differentiation over
right.
the long term.
What Dr. Alarian just said there, folks, is absolutely critical. I just sent out the yen versus the Korean won, and that's the first category of successful protection given this crisis as we see Turkey. Now, how do those two subsets, Dr. Alarian, of emerging markets redound upon the United States? I mean, obviously, we like stability like Korea. Should we fear the instability of the Turkeys of the world?
So in the short term, everything is going to look unstable, and that's because technicals dominate. And those of us who have been through cycles will always remember that no matter how much you believe in fundamentals, you've got to respect technicals in the short term. And when capital comes out, people tend to sell across the board. So short term is instability, and for investors, you're going to have pockets of value emerge when fundamentally good names get undermined excessively by technicals. Longer term, we should care because of the feedback loop back in the United States. And I think what we're going to see, and you saw this overnight, is you're going to see a tightening of financial conditions in emerging markets. You're going to see growth more challenged, and the ability of U.S. companies to get top-line growth from emerging markets is going to be less going forward.
Okay, that feedback loop into the United States brings up something that I always loved you to hear you talk about, which is the unfortunate incidence of corner solutions. In this case, the refusal of the fiscal authority to make the necessary trade-offs in relationship to monetary policy. Is the United States stuck in a seemingly endless cul-de-sac?
It's stuck for now because of Congress in a very unbalanced mix, policy mix. Too much monetary, not enough everything else. And when you're stuck in too much monetary, not enough everything else, you don't get the growth response you're expecting. And you start worrying, as the Fed has, about, quote, the costs and risks, or what we prefer to call the collateral damage and unintended consequences of this unbalanced policy mix.
Okay, well, Mohammed, August on Bloomberg Surveillance is math-free. So we're going to dive into September. If Joe Bruzuelas can talk about corner solutions, I can talk about degrees of freedom. What are our degrees of freedom? What are our options going forward? Or are we and our Europe and is Japan constrained by too few degrees of freedom?
So technically, and that's what makes me pull my hair out, technically we're not constrained. We can do this. The engineering solutions of a more balanced policy mix are not hard. The politics is difficult, but the engineering solutions are not hard. So in the U.S., it's not an engineering issue, it's a political issue. You go to Europe, it's more of an engineering problem, and it's also a political issue. You go to Japan, it's a real engineering problem. So in Japan, you have the politics that are aligned with Prime Minister Abe really in control, and yet you already see how difficult it is
right
to put the three arrows in play.
Bloomberg Surveillance, weekday mornings at 7 Eastern. In New York on Bloomberg 1130. In Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2. Or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2013 Bloomberg LP.